This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's program, I think, is essential for you parents and your grandparents, because it has to do with how to properly raise kids to be healthier. The title of the book we're going to talk about is Let Them Eat Dirt. And that may sound confusing because we're clean freaks. Cleanliness is next to godliness. That's been inculcated in us. But it may turn out that the hygiene hypothesis, whereby we keep our kids sequestered from all manner of bacterial invasion, maybe to their detriment. The subtitle of the book is How Microbes Can Make Your Child Healthier. And today we're going to talk to one of the co-authors. She's Dr. Marie-Claire Arrieta. And Dr. Arrieta is an assistant professor at the University of Calgary. And she is the originator of cutting-edge research on the role of key intestinal bacterial species on such problems as asthma in young babies. In fact, her research was deemed a breakthrough in the field and was reported by news outlets around the world in 2015. She's published in leading scientific journals such as Gastroenterology, Science Translational Medicine. These are very, very highly rated medical journals. And in addition, she's a mom. So she has practical experience implementing all this theoretical stuff in her daily life. So it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine, Dr. Arrieta. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's talk about this proposition. The hygiene hypothesis, that's what you're talking about here. And how did it get started, and where do we go wrong?
Well, the hygiene hypothesis started from an epidemiology study where, you know, they looked at babies in Europe that had a higher risk of developing asthma, a lower risk, and they found that babies that were raised in farms or babies that came from very numerous families, so, you know, they had 3-4 siblings, they had a lower risk of developing this. So, you know, great clinician, without any, you know, evidence, this was more of an observational study, but he didn't have the scientific causal evidence, but he said it's probably because these kids are getting exposed to more germs, they're probably getting sick more, and that's how it all started.
So another way of saying it is that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger?
In a way, but this was about 25 years ago. So what he proposed first has been proven both correct and incorrect for certain things. So, for example, yes, it is true. You know, if you're more exposed to germs, that is good for you early on. However, that doesn't extrapolate to germs that cause disease. So actually getting lots of respiratory infections when you're a baby, that's actually going to increase your risk of developing asthma. So yeah, sure. Getting dirty and being exposed to other people early in life, that's definitely good for you. But when it comes to getting sick or getting exposed to, you know, bugs that can give you respiratory diseases or flus or diarrhea, that's not so good for you. So we have to take the hygiene hypothesis with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Well, absolutely, because there are good and bad bugs. And
exactly.
Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch and all the people who created the paradigm were in antibiotics were introduced and sanitation measures were introduced. They weren't all wrong, but there were some consequences. So how is it we have set our kids up for health problems later in adulthood? What are some of the things that may predispose them to problems?
Well, the main issue is that we did not know about this until very, very recently. So by, you know, making sure our kids were clean and giving them antibiotics, perhaps too early or without need to, because no one thought that they had any side effects, we were trying to improve their health, right? This is us trying to make our kids grow better and stronger. But what we did not know until recently is that this had a collateral damage on what we call now our microbiome, or this large community of microbes that lives in and on us, and it is as part of our body as another organ. It's very intrinsically involved in many of the physiological processes that we do, and especially growing up. They're really important when we're growing up. So this was, you know, not on purpose, but as we cleaned up our world, and as we thought, you know, we have to become as clean as possible, we became, as we call it in the book, hyper hygienic. Hygiene is extremely important, but we already know what measures lead to disease prevention. It seems that in the past decades we have gone above and beyond those measures, and we're just cleaning ourselves just for the sake of cleaning ourselves.
Right. And so the microbiome in its normal state actually has a lot to do with our natural immunity, our susceptibility to allergies. There's even a brain-gut connection, which we'll talk about, a connection to inflammatory disorders, autoimmune disorders. So how do we mess up our kids' microbiome? Is it the wrong diets? Is it around breastfeeding? Is it the overuse of antibiotics? All of the above?
Yeah, so there's unfortunately many different ways. So there's a couple of concepts that make this a bit easier to understand. And the fact, what happens when we're born, we have no microbes. And then we start acquiring them. We start getting colonized, you know, from minute one after birth.
It's like buying a new computer that has, you know, has basically a hard disk that needs to be programmed. So you still download all the programs from the outside. Hopefully you don't get a virus. I mean, the analogy is perfect because, you know, we now talk about computer viruses. So you just want good programs and not programs that will hijack your computer.
Exactly. So the problem is that during that first year of acquiring these microbes, this community is not very well established, and it's not very resilient to change. So it has a hard time going back to its original state if a disturbance happens. The disturbance can be, and I think you alluded to some of them, antibiotics, also a C-section birth, and poor diets. Those are the three main ones, along with, you know, just not being exposed to enough outside or enough dirt. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that first year, those first 2 years of life, is when we have to be really careful. But that really coincides with the time when babies are giving formula, which is very different to breast milk in many ways, especially when it comes to ways that affect the microbiome, and also, you know, birth, C-section versus vaginal birth, and especially diet. I mentioned, of course, formula versus breastfeeding, but when it comes to babies introducing solid foods, we eat very differently now, and unfortunately we have managed to remove a huge amount of fiber from our diets, including the diets that we introduce to babies as young as 4 to 6 months of age. So there's many ways how we can alter this microbiome.
And fiber, or the right kind of fiber, acts as food for the right beneficial bacteria. So that, in fact, there's a word for that. They're called prebiotics as opposed to probiotics. They actually feed the good bacteria and help them flourish.
Yeah, that's correct. And what the latest studies are showing is that the best thing that you can do is to not only increase the amount of fiber that you take, but to vary the types of fibers. And fibers, you know, they come in vegetables, they come in fruit, but they come in grains too. And unfortunately, especially when it comes to grains, this is the first component that gets removed during food processing. You know, when you look at baby cereals, they're usually refined rice mm-hmm. cereals or refined, you know, barley or wheat. So the practical advice here is to try and opt for non-refined or whole cereals.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk a little bit about timing of introduction of foods and what types of foods to encourage and what types of foods to avoid, especially in an allergy-prone child a little later. But let's talk about normal vaginal delivery versus C-section. So what's happening here, and why, with the prevalence of C-sections, are we undermining the integrity of the microbiome?
Well, great. As I mentioned before, we go from zero microbes to moving into a microbial world as soon as we're born. And nature has seen to it that we are born through one of the sites of the body that is super highly loaded with microbes, such as the vagina and also the feces, because of that proximity. So babies literally get this load of microbes, and that's just part of this natural process that evolution has designed for mammals. And lots of people are speculating, including myself, that there is a reason for it. There's a huge advantage to get colonized with the right kind of microbes, because not all microbes are the same when it comes to how well adapted they are to our own physiology, and vice versa, how we are adapted to microbes. So it makes sense to get colonized with microbes that are going to be involved in the processes that are going to be beneficial for our physiology, whether it is immune development, whether it is a neurodevelopment, and so on. With a C-section, babies that are born via C-section, their microbiome differs from vaginally delivered babies for about 6 weeks to about 3 months of age, more or less. And this period of time really matches some very critical events when it comes to immune and neurodevelopment, and also metabolic development as well. So that's the catch with C-sections, right? I mean, it's a very innocuous procedure. Otherwise, yeah, there is an increased risk for certain things. But to me, what really would convince me against a C-section if I were to have the option is this. How important is this transfer of microbes that happens only during vaginal birth?
Is there any way to compensate for that for women who, I mean, in some circumstances, women who are very desirous of natural childbirth really have to undergo C-section. So is there any way that they can play catch-up ball?
Yeah, I mean, breastfeeding would be definitely the best way, close contact with your baby. There's now a procedure that is being tested. It has been tested before in a small group, only 100 women in the United States. They're doing I think the one that they're doing right now is with about 3,000 women, and it's called vaginal seeding. And this would only work, of course, for planned C-sections, not so much for emergency ones. Mm-hmm. Whereas what happens is that babies that are delivered via C-section are impregnated with a clot that has been put in the vaginal canal for about 15 minutes before birth. And that is just, you know, used to cover the baby, and that mimics that passage that would naturally happen.
So it reintroduces some of these missing bacteria.
It does, and and it's been shown that it does. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, one has to rule out some of the things that, at least in
bad
in Canada,
and so on.
Exactly. Yeah, right. And normally that happens during pregnancy here, at least in Canada. In other places, it might not. So there's some safety risks. For example, if you're group B strep positive, for example, this is something that all women in Canada get tested mm-hmm. for. And if you're negative, then you should be fine to do this procedure.
Now, you also state in the book, I mean, there's some remarkable studies and remarkable facts that you state in the book, along with your co-author, Dr. Finley. You state that there's evidence that when kids take antibiotics frequently, that they have a much higher risk of childhood and eventually adolescent and adulthood obesity. So what's
That's
going
right.
on there?
So again, it comes down to, and these have been observational studies in humans, but there's been a lot of stuff done in animal models that really show that there is a cause and effect there between the antibiotic, the change in the microbiome, and then the changes in metabolism that leads to obesity. So there's an antibiotic, especially early in life, is going to really disturb that microbiome. And in many cases, it's going to select for a microbiome that is going to be what we call now obesity prone. So these are types of microbes that are really good at extracting energy from food. So we get more energy from the food that we eat. And it also changes some aspects of our metabolism that favor fat deposit versus, you know, fat usage. So it can really alter our metabolism.
So there's a lot of talk now about how to properly introduce foods to kids. Now, the old dictum, and, you know, I remember back when that was the standard wisdom, was that if your child was allergic, showed signs of allergies, or perhaps both parents had perhaps some allergic condition, asthma, eczema, and the child was at risk for allergy, that you had to withhold certain potentially allergenic foods until much later, till at least 2 years of age, and then you could introduce those foods. Now there's some new think about when to introduce some of these foods.
That's right. So there's been a change in policy or recommendations both in Canada, in the United States, and in other places of Europe as well. And this, as you well explained it, this was when I had my kids, that's exactly what we had to do. And I come from an allergic family, so I know I had to wait until my kids were older for that. But there's been a change. So now we're supposed to introduce allergenic foods, including, the usual suspects, peanuts and eggs and all of those, to introduce them early as 4 to 7 months, as early as you would introduce normal solid foods, and to do it slowly, just like when you introduce a new food, right? You do it slowly and you introduce it all by itself without other foods so that you can rule out any possible reaction to it. So that's the new recommendation. What it's been shown is that during this time in life, in human life, this is when the immune system is more tolerogenic. And that, what that means is that it is more likely to create tolerance to a particular food or a particular, in this case, allergen, such as the peanut allergen or the egg one. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there has been a change in that. I know, for example, that it depends. So if it's the third sibling and all of them have developed peanut allergies, then that might not happen, and then at that point you have to consult with your allergist as to what's the best to do. But for the general population, yes, you should include all foods, including allergenic ones, early.
And I recently shared with listeners the results of a study, and maybe you're familiar with it since this is right in your wheelhouse, a study where they tolerized kids to peanuts. These are kids with potentially life-threatening allergies to peanuts. And please don't try this at home. Only do so under experienced allergist supervision. But they were, under experimental circumstances, they were fed first infinitesimal amounts, almost homeopathic amounts of the peanuts, and then progressively more until they tolerated it. But an essential part of the program was that they were also given probiotics. So the suggestion is that there may be a microbiome-mediated effect in tolerance, that somehow the microbiome also makes kids potentially more tolerant or less tolerant, depending on the condition of the microbiome, to certain foods.
That's correct. Yeah. So this was a recent Australian study where they were using that. They call that immunotherapy, and they've been doing it for a while with good results for peanuts and for eggs, especially in these really severe cases where kids, even if they don't become completely tolerant to the allergen, they can at least become tolerant enough so that, let's say, for example, if they go in a plane or if they go to school and they their skin becomes in contact, that they don't get an anaphylactic reaction. And yeah, indeed, they found in the group that received the probiotics that the tolerance effect was stronger.
That's pretty amazing. So there's also the effect of stress. And you talk about the impact of stress on, literally, on the bacterial composition of the intestine. How does that work?
Yeah, it is really fascinating. Well, people that have studied that the stress response for the longest time, they have always included the gut when it comes to stress, and for most nervous responses too. So the gut outside of your brain is the tissue that has the highest concentration of nervous tissue as well. So it's not that surprising to know, and especially if you've suffered from a stress or anxiety before, to know that your brain is truly connected to your gut. And your gut is where these microbes live. So there's a change in your gut that can definitely change your microbiome, and vice versa. If there is a change in your microbiome, that will potentially cause some changes. So there was a study that was done. One was observational in humans, which showed that people that were prone to depression, if they have antibiotics, they can have flares of depressive episodes. And then there's another study.
The antibiotics made them flare in their depression.
Yes. Yeah. And then there's another study in animals that was done as well, and they were able to show that if they induce depression, that depression can actually worsen if under the effects of antibiotics. There's this, you know, vice versa or bidirectional communication with the bugs and our immune system through the gut and the other way around.
And another culprit, and you know, you see, I see kids at birthday parties and so on. In fact, I'm going to a birthday party for a relative in a couple of weeks, and you know, the kids are eating the birthday cake and eating the candy, and they're bouncing off the walls. They've got a little bouncy house, and they go a little nuts. Well, that's, you know, the transient effect of sugar, the sugar high. But what's the long-term effect of sugar on the gut and the immune system?
Well, the problem with highly processed and high sugar foods is that they end up starving many of the microbes that depend on non-sugary and non-fibrous foods. So the main problem is that yes, if you're going to go and have a piece of cake every now and then, that's probably fine if your diet is normally well balanced and high in fiber. The problem is that, especially in this generation and somewhat in the previous generation as well, there wasn't much attention, or there isn't much attention put into the diet of kids. And kids are just, you know, recognized, oh, he's just a picky eater and he would only eat, you know, mac and cheese and hamburgers. That is the main issue. If your diet consists of high sugar, high carbohydrate, low fibrous foods, you are going to you're going to breed a very poor microbiome, one that really is not going to enrich for those microbes that are associated with the health benefits that we are studying.
And what about artificial sweeteners? Are they an acceptable alternative?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, not according to the studies that have come out, especially some recently. I'm actually involved in one at the moment. The first thing that they observed was that babies that were born to mothers that during pregnancy, they had a very high intake of artificial sweeteners, and this was one or more diet beverages per day. They had a higher body mass index at year one. And this complements the other studies that have come out.
I mean, it's already been demonstrated in consumers of diet soda that it doesn't work.
Exactly.
Their offspring were affected. Wow.
Yeah. And this is after, you know, correcting for the weight of the mom. And, you know, this is after, you know, deconfounding what you call that, the other possible explanations of this phenomenon.
The other possible explanation is that, okay, they're overweight already, so that's why they're using diet drinks, and that could be the reason. But then that was already, you know, there are ways to correct for that effect.
Exactly. It was after
samples.
A correction of that. Mm-hmm. And now what we're doing, and we've had some preliminary results showing that, there's actually quite large microbiome changes explained by the very high intake of these artificial sweeteners. It's been shown in animals that it changes the microbiome, and it changes in a way that it promotes weight gain, which is exactly the opposite that for what you're taking it for. So learning about the microbiome, if we didn't have microbes, yes, artificial sweeteners would work. because, you know, it's just, we're not getting the calories. The problem is that these artificial sweeteners can be digested and metabolized by microbes. And the changes that happen because of these microbiome alterations, they can change our metabolism into gaining more weight.
Okay. Well, we've set the stage for a discussion in part two of how to practically implement a program to make your child's microbiome healthier. Remember, you're not just raising children. You're also cultivating their microbiomes, because their microbiomes are going to be crucial to their health going forward. And that's the
right
proposition in this book, Let Them Eat Dirt. We're talking to one of the authors, Marie Claire Arrieta. She's a PhD researcher. And we'll be right back with more of Intelligent Medicine. So stay with us.